somebody sure knows me. What's this?
Today was my 21st birthday. Yukiko, Rei, and the staff at the agency held a party for me. It was terrific. Coming home, I went grocery shopping at the usual store. I bought myself mineral water and milk. I get the best water, and the milk just has to be cow brand. I have to allow myself at least that luxury. And of course I get the right brand of food for my precious fish, the kind they like. May 12th, I was impressed with Eri Ochiai's performance in Double Bind. She becomes another person when the camera is rolling.
Where did this come from? How do they know so much?
Excuse me, who are you? Excuse me, who are you?
What is up, everyone? Welcome back to the Registry Movie Podcast, the podcast where everything is connected. I'm your host, Jacob Thompson, and joining me is my co-host, friend, and the person most likely to not know how to log into the World Wide Web, Alex Perkins. Perk, how are you doing tonight?
I was really curious where you were going to go with the intro here, and I'm glad that it went where it did.
I always try to find like a silly, goofy thing, and it's like, this movie was hard, but I got one.
Not a lot of goofy, but yeah, I do struggle with the internet. I don't even know what we're doing right now. Are we broadcasting on the line?
Yeah, I know. I do all the work. You just sit there and look pretty. And
I'm the quote-unquote talent.
Well, there we go. Welcome back to the show, everyone. This is the podcast where every week Perk and I review a movie connected to the last one we watched. If you like our show, we post pretty much every Friday on podcast services and YouTube. Also, make sure to follow us on TikTok if you want to see some clips from the show. You can share those with your friends, too. Maybe they'll come listen with us. But last week, we watched the movie Paprika, and we followed the director Satoshi Kon to this week's film, Perfect Blue, which was showing in theaters as a special 25th anniversary event. And Perk and I saw it together, which was fun. We don't normally get to see these movies together because we hate each other in real life.
Yes, correct.
But Perk, why don't you introduce movies for us?
Yeah, all right. So Perfect Blue is a 1997 joint directed by the aforementioned Satoshi Kon. It is a story about a pop idol in Japan turned actress and her struggles in her career, along with the presence of a obsessed stalker fan and and even more devious stuff. Couple fun facts about this one. It was originally supposed to be a live-action movie until a bunch of funding was pulled by backers. And so it had to be anime instead, which, good call, in my opinion. And then there's a scene involving a bathtub, which inspired director Darren Aronofsky in the movie Requiem for a Dream.
But yeah, you've seen that one.
No, I haven't.
Oh, I thought you had.
Have you ever, like, just had the thought, like, I want to watch Requiem for a Dream right now?
No, but you've tried to get us to watch it on the podcast.
Probably at some point.
Bringing it up a couple of times. Well, yeah. So, yeah, we watched Perfect Blue yesterday. Why don't you go first, Perk? What did you think of it?
Forgive the coarse language. This is a giga banger. This movie is so good, dude. I'm kind of obsessed. I think it starts off a touch slow, but it needs to be there for establishing. And then once it gets going, goodness me, this is one of the most tense thrillers I've ever seen, bar none, in any medium.
Yeah, no, I'm there with you. I agree. I think it is a bit slow.
Which, again, it's so weird to say that about an 80-minute movie.
I know, right? Yeah.
Because it isn't slow once it gets going, but it does meander a little bit at the start.
Yeah. But yeah, I mean, I agree. The tension at the end and just the way it was, I guess I would call it directed or just sequenced of, I fucking love match cuts, Perk. And this movie has so many match cuts where she opens a door and then it opens the door in a flashback, or she looks over her shoulder and it's, you know, flat. Like, I love that shit. And just the disorientation you feel, like, in the when we're approaching the climax is just insane. Like, what the fuck is going on? Like, she's losing it. And I love, by the end, everything is clear. And it's a very satisfying ending. That's my issue with other Satoshi Kon projects, like Paprika and Paranoia Agent, where we got, like, the quote-unquote, like, twist or reveal, and I'm still confused. Whereas this one, it's a very satisfying, like, twist, and everything makes sense. And you're like, okay, cool. That was awesome. I was scared as shit there for a bit, but now I'm okay because everything was resolved. So, yeah, it's hard for me to say I like this movie because it's so uncomfortable to watch, but it's very, very good. It's a very quality film.
Yeah, I have no trouble saying I liked it. In fact, I loved it. It was, oh man, it was so good. I'm so glad we got to see this on a big screen, in a, you know, marginally full theater. It added to the experience for sure.
Yeah. And yeah, speaking to the slow start, I think the reason it's slow is because for like a bit there, we like know who the stalker is. We know why they're doing it. And we know generally like how they're doing stuff. So it's kind of like, where's the intrigue, you know?
Yeah, it's never really... There's a rug pull, obviously, but the rug pull is not the ultra creepy weirdo being a stalker. Like,
yeah, it's like we already know that.
It is very clear from the get-go that this ultra creepy weirdo who's animated as if like he's wearing a skin mask.
Yeah.
And just scraggled teeth, like one of the most unsettling depictions of a person in anime I've ever seen. It's pretty obvious he's the stalker, and then he is. Yeah. So yeah,
we even see him writing on the website. Like there's no it's obviously ambiguity. Him. Yeah, no ambiguity. So it's like, okay, why am I like where's the tension as far as like the mystery of it all, right?
Right.
But then it's when she starts, we get that disorientation where like all of her aspects of her life are merging together of she's acting and the scene is very similar to her real life, and then you know, she has this other version of herself. She's like, are you real? Am I real? And she starts completely, like, disassociating, essentially. That's where the tension really ramps up. And then we get the final twist, which at first I thought maybe there wasn't enough hints of. But, like, thinking back, I think there are enough hints that, is it Ruri or Rumi?
Rumi
was, like, the psychotic person kind of orchestrating it all. And then that final just, like, chase and, like, slasher shit at the end was, like, so tense and hard to watch for me.
Yeah, that scene was so good because not only does it it has some really cool bits in it where you see it's Mima is running away and the like pop idol Mima is just floating around behind her, but then you see in a reflection along a building that it's Rumi just absolutely running as fast as she can.
Yeah, just dogging it,
Yep. So, and I think that plays so well once we get that reveal because Mima's been seeing this reflection of herself, the idol version of herself, and clearly she's, you know, mentally having an episode, but the ghost version of herself was actually there.
Yeah.
It's Rumi. And I think that is so effective because it shows like, yes, she's losing her marbles a little bit, but it's warranted because this ghost is not like, I forget the quote, but it's illusions can't be real or something like that. And this is like a real illusion.
Yeah. Yeah. No, yeah. Yeah. That in hindsight, that's at first I was kind of like, okay, I don't know if I like if the storyline of the show is this close to what's actually happening. Because like Rumi did actually end up having like multiple personality disorder. And I'm like, I don't know about that. But like they said that illusion line so many times and I kept hearing it. I'm like, yeah, okay, where's this going to go? And then, it's her illusion actually being a real person. And it works so well because you're like, okay, the creeper guy, he seemed to be there a lot, but he had too much info. So somebody closer had to be feeding him info. And there was one moment where I thought it was Rumi, or I'm like, she's always like, she's sitting by Mima and she could have got some like the dialogue recorded, but I just totally forgot about it because we're focused so much on the stalker guy, which slowed down the movie, but also like pushed in your face. He's the only person, he has no accomplice. So I think it kind of worked for that. But then the fact that like Rumi's like reorganizing, like she's the one who's taking her to and from places. She's reorganizing her apartment without her knowing, like all of this shit that's just adding to her like paranoia and like she doesn't have a grip on reality because yeah, somebody's literally changing her reality without her knowing. So like it works so well by the end.
I absolutely love the rug pull too, because there was never a moment that I saw it coming that Rumi was going to be the twist villain, because, and I noticed this immediately when I was watching it, Rumi is the only character in the movie that we are told to trust. That it's so well set up that she's like the motherly figure who just wants what's best. But when you extend that, when you think about it hard, it's like the person who is most disturbed by this transition and the exploitation, the most disturbed person is obviously the stalker fan, right? But no, there's one other person in the movie who is very disturbed by what Mima's doing, and it's Rumi. And it's like, oh wow. And we were given that backstory that she used to be a pop star in a very subtle, it's just a line, which makes it even better, because if we spent too much time like showing, you know, when Rumi was a pop star, it would maybe give it away a little bit, but I thought the way that they handled it, it was a rug pull that I did not see coming at all. I did not see Rumi as the twist villain. But when you pick apart, it makes perfect sense from the start of the film. Because even at the start, too, Rumi is arguing with the other agent.
Yeah,
she's Tadakoro, arguing that Mima should stay a pop star. And what does Mima want? And that type of thing. So. Yeah.
Well, and that's the thing, too, is like after the literal like bomb in the envelope, I'm like, why the fuck are they not calling the cops? And like Mio brings that up and Rumi's like, ah, well, Tadakoro said he didn't want to. But it's like, I think that was actually, you know, Rumi being like, no, like, I'm going to manipulate you how I want you to. We're not getting the cops involved. Like, because I'm like, why is the last movie, like, why is nobody helping this woman? And it's because the person that's supposed to help her is the one who's actually manipulating her. And it's just like so fucked up. That and all, like, there's that whole, that's like most of the movie. But then we also just get like standard, maybe not standard, but there's like exploitation of Mima in other ways, which is also equally hard to watch. And it's just like so like frustrating and sad of, because she's also like struggling with her identity of like what she wants to be. And she's kind of just gets pushed and pulled by other people and doesn't really get to make decisions for herself. And watching her just get exploited over and over and over again is just so hard to watch, man.
Yes. And also I think that they deal with that. There's a particular scene where they expose how traumatized she is.
Yeah.
When her fish all die and you know, it's not, I mean, fish die.
Yeah.
It happens. It's not worth, you know, losing it, but it's just, it's the straw that breaks the camel's back. Yeah. It's just, you know, something that, you know, you were holding it together and then you caught this out of nowhere, just your fish are dead. And all of a sudden it's just a full catharsis, a full like waterworks breakdown, just exposing that trauma. And I think that it ties into, there are a couple of themes in this movie that I think are very sadly still incredibly relevant.
Oh yeah. 100%.
Yeah, when you think about, because they're talking, when they get a computer for Mima, it's like this is new technology, and it's 1997, so this is new technology. The fact that they dive into having like a stalker with this parasocial relationship with someone that they only know through media, the fact it's still so relevant today, where you see like people buying $30,000 cars for Twitch streamers. It's just so creepy. And the fact that right at the start of like the computer era, you've got a story delving into this weird online parasocial relationship dynamic is crazy. Yeah. 25 years ago, it's almost premonition of what's like happening today. And then to counter that with everything, the other main theme I found in this movie is with everything happening with like Harvey Weinstein and how women in Hollywood almost feel that they need to exploit themselves in order to get ahead. The movie plays with that in a very interesting way as well, and showing how traumatizing it is for actresses. So
yeah,
it's crazy to me how thematically relevant this movie is, despite being 25 years old.
Yeah, no, I completely agree with everything you just said. And just to add on to that with how the themes and then tie back into the plot, the scene where she breaks down because her fish die is like so amazing and it's so well done. But then she wakes up and her fish are alive. It's like, yeah, because Rumi fucking replaced the fish. And then...
Oh, no. So, sorry to interject.
Go ahead.
I'm pretty sure that they were actually just at Rumi's apartment. And Rumi's bedroom is a scale model of Mima's bedroom.
So it is, but we're back at her apartment for a bit because her room gets more and more messy. There's more and more bags of stuff around. And like those reporters come after the photographer dies to like her apartment. So we're definitely in her apartment at some point. I got the impression that she like replaced the fish.
Well, so my read on it was that the fish are alive and that's unsettling. So she goes to the window and sees that it's not the view from her room.
Well, that's
it's
way
like
later.
A different view.
I'm saying like I'm pretty sure she sees the fish are dead. She breaks down. The next morning she wakes up and the fish are alive.
Oh.
So I think Rumi broke in and like replaced her fish to like.
Maybe. I don't know. I don't remember.
I don't remember seeing
the fish again. It would be something to look out for on a second watching. But
yeah.
Yeah.
But the other thing with the parasocial just website stuff. The fact that Rumi bought her or got her or helped her with the computer because I think she wanted Mima to see the real Mima, the person she should be, and wanted this fan page to convince her to go back to normal. And it's all just so like insidious and like fucked.
Mm-hmm.
Like, oh my God. Yeah. It's so well crafted, man.
Yeah. No, go ahead.
The other two, we were in the trivia that this was supposed to be a live action film.
Yeah.
And I think I can see it because there's not a ton of really fantastical stuff in this. Like, it's really just the other Mima. But besides that, it's pretty much like it could have been live action. But I think it works really well, man. And just all like, I thought the violence in particular was incredibly like striking. Like when, I guess Rumi kills the photographer, that whole scene is super like violent and fucked up. When she like he tries to reach for the phone, she stabs his like through his hand into the phone, like all that stuff. Mm-hmm. I'm like, oh my God. And I thought, I'm like, did Mima kill him? Because she woke up, we see the reflection, and she has the clothes in her apartment. I mean, they got me, man. Like, yeah, it's. But yeah, I'm glad it was animated, but I think I can see why they how they transitioned from live action to animated, because a lot of it is just like real stuff. You know what I mean?
Right. I do think that specifically in that chase scene through the city, I think that probably works better because it was animated, especially with that mirror image thing, which you could do in live action, but it might look a little hammy,
just a little weird.
Just the illusory Mima just bouncing behind her. I think that is just such a good use of the medium of animation.
Yeah.
I think it's so effective, and I'm glad it was animated because that scene absolutely shines.
Yeah. Yeah. So yeah, man, it's an incredible movie. Like I said, I'm a favorite Satoshi Kon project. Definitely recommend it. I don't know what I would recommend based on this. Like I got way more just like horror vibes. So maybe like a slasher type film. That's not my bag. So I'm not good in recommending stuff. That was kind of the vibes I got from this.
So I'll come back to that, but there was one more thing I wanted to touch on.
Go for it.
This is maybe the best sound design I've ever seen in a movie.
Wow.
I know it's high praise, and I didn't think too hard. It's one of the best sound design thrillers at a minimum.
Mm.
Just some of the ways that they use like subtle grinding noises or really just unsettling background music. Not even like, ooh, spooky, but just like tones that make you feel uneasy.
Yeah.
I thought were great. And the one moment that springs to mind is when the screenwriter is killed in the parking garage,
mm-hmm.
and he hears just the music in the background, but then when the elevator opens and there's just a blaring music from a boombox that is also incredibly distorted.
Yeah.
It's blowing out the speakers.
Yeah.
Yes. That distortion sound really ratchets up like the tension in that scene. And you know, he gets killed off screen, but just sitting there in my seat in the theater, I'm just like gripping my armrest.
Cause yeah.
I know it's, he's done. I know it's over. And I was blown away by that because you can tell kind of what's going to happen in that scene just by reading what's going on in the movie. But that distortion that they bring up with the boombox was so incredible.
No, I'm glad you brought that up because I totally forgot about that. But yeah, that, I don't know how they captured that so well. Cause like, we've all heard that sound when you're playing music too loud on like a shitty speaker mm-hmm. and it's just super blown out. But like, and we hear that in real life, you're like, oh, that's whatever. But in this context, it's like super scary. And yes. They just captured that sound so, so, so well. So yeah, that's a great shout. And I guess just touching on like the technicality of the film a bit, I was a bit worried at the beginning. I don't know if you noticed this, but the very first scene, we're getting kind of different people outside the concert venue, kind of talking to each other and stuff.
Yeah.
And like, when people mm-hmm. were talking, when their mouse movies, their entire model was moving, and it just seemed like the animation frames like weren't fully lined up in the, you know, camera roll or however they did it. And I was like, oh, is this going to like, I mean, it's 25 years old, so I knew it's not going to look like amazing, but like, I was hoping it'd be solid. But I think after that, it kind of got better.
After that first scene, it got better.
Yeah. Like, you can tell it's dated, but it still shows its
age, but not to a point where it detracts.
Yeah.
Also, another fun fact I saw while scouring the line, that interweb that I mm-hmm. can't understand. the original 35mm print of this film was lost or destroyed, so they had to use a lower resolution version and just blow it up.
Yeah.
Which I think that probably also contributes a little bit
yeah,
to
definitely.
That problem.
Yeah, I would have loved to see the original just to see how much clearer it is.
For sure.
Yeah.
Especially imagine being one of those animators. You worked so hard on all these cells just for it all to blow up because someone left a coffee pot on or something.
Yeah, who knows? But you know, it looked totally fine. And I mean, you're there for the story, and the story was immaculate. So,
yes. To circle back to my recommendations, I would say once again, like, the Fincher-esque thrillers are a good shout, mm-hmm. but there is a almost uncanny, like for sure, inspiration in BoJack Horseman season 5.
Mm.
If you remember that one, it's not one of my favorite seasons, but there are so many parallels because BoJack is shooting a crime thriller show, also going through drug addiction, to the point where he's blurring between his real life and the show.
Yeah.
And like he'll just be walking around his house and he'll be in full costume and stuff like that. And the parallels between his life and what's going on in the show are really powerful. So I think.
Yeah, that's a great shot, man.
There is
yeah.
very obviously some clear inspiration drawn because it's the same type of thing in Perfect Blue, where the show she's acting on is an odd mirroring of what's going on in her real life
mm-hmm.
To the point where under all this stress and trauma, her brain, she's blurring the lines between what's real, what's the TV show.
Yeah.
Which also like that whole portion of the movie where her reality is blurring is so effective. So well done.
Well, dude, the scene after she whacks the stalker with the hammer and it stands up and she hears like the clapping from the team or whatever, like the shot, the show. I was like, oh god, she's losing it, man. And then he's all gone, like it's gone, and the crime scene's all cleaned up, and it's like, what the fuck? And it's like, that's right when Rumi reveals herself. But you're making me think I need to rewatch BoJack, but I also don't want to because that season is super hard to watch for other reasons.
I got too much to rewatch.
There's not enough time, but
at some point,
in the future, but. Yeah, well, there you go. That's our review of Perfect Blue. Definitely try to see it if you can. I think it is available to watch somewhere streaming. I think I said Tubi last week, maybe, or rentable. I don't like. Me personally, I'd recommend Paprika just for the animation, but I think for this one, this is like super solid. You gotta check it out.
I think, yeah, Paprika I loved, but the way that the story in Perfect Blue is just a little more grounded,
mm-hmm.
despite being still a little bit all over the place, I think it's a little easier to follow and has a far more satisfying conclusion.
Yeah, 100%. I think that's for me. I don't like to be that guy that's like the ending, good or bad, like makes the whole movie. But mm-hmm. like, I kind of am that guy. Like, I just really like when you have a mystery like this that has a satisfying conclusion. That's what I'm there for. So, yeah, I think this one totally nailed it. All right, well, there we go. Perk, you got two bonus reviews for me this week. What'd you watch?
Yeah, I got a little two-pack. I just was in the mood because I was thinking about him and hadn't seen him in a while. But the HBO sports mockumentaries, first one being 2015's 7 Days in Hell,
mm-hmm.
and the second being 2017's Tour de Pharmacy,
mm-hmm.
Which both are just like 40-minute little mini mockumentaries about fake sporting events that are just absolutely fantastic. And the funniest thing in that genre, I'll give it, it's not a very big genre, but just absolutely nonstop laughs for the entire runtime of both. The mm-hmm. first one is a 7-day tennis match between Andy Samberg and Kit Harington, with all the twists you'd hope and just belly laughs throughout. And then the second one is about a year when the Tour de France, everyone except 5 riders got banned for bribing the drug test official.
Mm-hmm.
And so the 5 remainder are Orlando Bloom, John Cena, Andy Samberg again, that one guy who I never know his name, and David Diggs.
Yeah, I'm blanking on his name right now too. But yeah.
You know who I'm talking about.
I know you're talking about. I'm blanking. Yeah.
And it follows the stories of these, you know, 5 cyclists who were all extreme steroided. The John Cena steroid jokes are just so funny.
Yeah, he's so good at it, man.
But yeah, I don't know. I don't want to say too much. Because
Freddie Highmore is who we're thinking of.
Freddie Highmore, yeah. They're such a unique experience watching these little like short films. I would very much recommend, if you have Max and you haven't seen these, watch them back to back as a little, because it's about the length of a short movie if you watch them back to back. And they are just so pleasant to watch, especially if you've got some mood altering substances in your blood.
Yeah, I think we watched Tour de Pharmacy not too long ago. I forgot to talk about it on the podcast, but yeah, I love both of these so much. I think 7 Days in Hell is slightly better.
Yeah.
But yeah, we need Kit Harington in more comedic roles, because he's so freaking funny.
He nails it.
7 Days in Hell.
Yeah. Indubitably.
And yeah, you can't go wrong with these movies. They're so dumb, but they just work. And
yes.
Yeah, it's a great time, man.
It's a real tragedy that HBO didn't make another one.
I know. I would kill for one of these a year. Like,
yeah, like I don't even know what it would be about. Maybe like golf.
Curling, I think,
curling,
could be funny.
Maybe,
like,
yeah. Just
like a biathlon where everybody gets shot or something. I don't know. They
a biathlon that turned bloody. Yeah.
Yeah. Like yeah. There's so many weird Olympic sports. Like, you do like the luge. Like, they could make one of these a year.
Oh,
easy.
Yeah.
And I mm-hmm. this. Yeah. I need more of them. But yeah, that's a great one. All right, well, that is our show for this week. We'll be continuing our anime film string next week with the probably most famous anime film of all time, Akira, or Akira, however you want to say it. It is streaming on Hulu and Crunchyroll, so you should be able to watch that. And we'll be talking about it next week. So until then, Akira on Hulu and Crunchyroll. We'll see you next time. Bye.
Bye-bye.